You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
And now, speaking for Christ and against communism, here is Billy James Hargis.
Developments in Red Cuba, 90 miles from the shores of Florida, hold more ominous warnings for a sleeping American public. While the deadly enemies of the American people close in for their final stages of encircling our nation, enemy nations within intensify efforts to chip away the foundations upon which American freedom rests. More and more strange voices call for surrendering of our national sovereignty to some type of world authority. There are increasing efforts to centralize authority in the federal government in Washington, D.C., under the guise of federal aid.
Welcome to the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. When we think of conservatism in the second half of the 20th century, we likely think of Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Rush Limbaugh, maybe for the history nerds out there, Robert Taft and AUH2O bumper stickers. We're thinking of, you know, cultural and intellectual conservatism. We maybe throw out names like Russell Kirk or William F. Buckley Jr., ideas like fusionism or the anti-communism of Whitaker Chambers. What we're probably not thinking of are card parties held by housewives, Polish ham, and talk radio evangelism. But if we're not thinking of those things, we're failing to understand ground-level conservatism around the country. To help us with our misunderstanding, we have on the line today Paul Matsko, author of the recent book, The Radio Right. Paul is a PhD in history. Dr. Matsko, I should say, is a PhD in history, works as an editor at the Cato Institute. Dr. Matsko, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. I suppose that if Jill Biden can't be called Dr. Biden, I should be called Dr. Matsko. So,
you know, there are things to get angry about, but man, like whether she's legitimately a doctor, there are some dumb cultural conversations going on, but that takes the cake. Listener, if the name sounds familiar to you, it should, because there was a Christian Profiles interview that went up, was it the beginning of last year? About a year ago, actually, with Jay Eldred, right when the book came out. So this book is just over a year old at this point, which tells you how long it takes me to get to things when the publisher sends them. Thanks so much for coming on the show. This was a fascinating book, and I'm kind of tempted to work backwards through it and kind of start with Rush Limbaugh and work the other way. But I've mentioned Polish ham. So we should dive into that first. Otherwise, our listeners are going to be wondering what on earth does Polish ham have to do with conservatism the whole time. Yeah. So maybe you can answer that for us. What does Polish ham have to do with 20th century conservatism?
Oh, I love starting there because the Polish ham chapter or the Great Polish Ham Boycott, I like to call it, is my favorite section because I'd never heard of it. And throughout the book, there's all these little and big stories that just completely were off my radar, even as a historian of the 60s and 70s. But what the Polish ham boycott was, put yourself in the mindset of the early 1960s. And, you know, you and I, we're not old enough to literally do that. We don't remember this time period. But some of our listeners might. They might have been, you know, teenagers or children. And in the early 1960s, it's the middle of the Cold War. The John F. Kennedy administration, we have a Democratic president who is seeking – now, he's a Cold Warrior. At the time in the 50s and 60s, Republicans and Democrats, they disagreed about some stuff, but one of the things they had consensus on was the need to fight global communism. And but they had different strategies about how to do so. And what the Kennedy administration wanted to do was to use a little more carrot and a little less stick. And the way they were going to use a carrot to fight communism was to try to woo nations that were behind the Iron Curtain. So countries in Eastern Europe, like Poland, some which were not technically under Soviet domination, but were still kind of communist affiliated, like Tito, the dictator Tito in Yugoslavia. So there was this attempt to try to peel them out of the Soviet zone of influence through trade, rather than having tight trade restrictions, high tariffs and formal sanctions on Eastern European countries. allow them to sell their goods to the U.S. and the U.S. to sell their exports to them, and that by doing so they would, you know, build an affinity for the U.S. and give the U.S. influence in those countries and make them more reliant on the U.S. and less reliant on the Soviet Union. Now, conservatives didn't like this. They thought this was a bad idea. We have our own version of this debate when it comes to the Western Hemisphere, and that's the debate over what to do with Cuba. Should we have tight sanctions that prohibit any kind of exchange with Cuba, or should we open up trade to try to peel them out, to show them what they're missing out on because of their communist command economy? So it's a very old debate, and this is debate in the early 60s. And the Kennedy administration says, no, we're going to open up trade. Congress had just given the president the power to unilaterally lower tariffs with foreign nations. He didn't have to go through Congress to lower those tariffs, as would have previously been true. Now, this is an interesting little tidbit. It's those same unilateral executive tariff powers that Donald Trump has been using the last couple of years to right. just raise tariffs on things like Canadian lumber and foreign steel and the like over the last few years, which is the opposite of the intended purpose, but it's the same power that was given to JFK. So Kennedy lowers these trade sanctions and allows the import of things like Polish ham, Hungarian wicker baskets, Yugoslavian folding chairs, and suddenly into the grocery stores of the grocery store nearest you, your neighborhood store where you go and get your stuff, suddenly you're starting to see products that say made in Poland. And all this was a very charged time. The idea that if you were buying a Polish ham, well, a lot of consumers, conservative consumers, thought that meant you were supporting the communist regime. Again, we have our own corollary to that. Back in the 90s, when I was a teen in junior high, I had a social studies teacher who was a very strict he wouldn't buy any goods made in China, because to do so was to support the communist Communist Party.
Wrong about that, by the way.
Right. Well, so it's still a very live debate now, but that was what was going on in conservatives' heads at the time, that if you buy goods from Eastern Europe, you're supporting communist regimes. So a chiropractor in Miami starts a boycott movement. It stays pretty local until right-wing radio broadcasters, there's this network of them by the early 60s. They basically hadn't existed a few years before, but by the early 60s, they're on hundreds of stations nationwide. Think of talk radio, but before talk radio. They start blasting out criticisms of the Eastern European trade policy, supporting the boycott, and this boycott goes viral. It goes national. There are chapters in every state in the country. They successfully push for local ordinances requiring stores that sell these Polish hams to put a little sign in their window saying, we sell communist products. Nice. What store wants to put that in their front window? There was a lot of grassroots organization. These chapters were mostly run by suburban middle-class housewives, and they would organize what were called card parties, where they would all get together and have kind of like a Tupperware party, but in this case, it's political activism. And these housewives would gather together. They would print off thousands of little cards, like little business card-shaped pieces of paper, with things like, always buy your communist groceries at Supergiant. And then they would go to the store, and they would just put those cards everywhere in the store, slip them in the packaging, put them in the, if it's a department store, put them in the breast coat pocket of all the suit jackets or in the pants pockets, slip them in the toothpaste tubes, all kinds of stuff. This is embarrassing for the stores to be littered with all these cards saying we support communism, basically, especially in the context of the time. But the problem was they're housewives. So if you call the police on them for trespassing, which they are doing, I mean, clearly this is private property and they're, if you call the cops on them, it makes you look bad. I mean, who wants a newspaper headline, wife of local chiropractor thrown in slammer, right?
Right.
By Supergiant. So it's a very effective boycott. It's so effective that the sale of goods like Polish hams drops by millions of dollars that year. The Polish embassy actually complains to the Kennedy administration about how effective the boycott is. Congress issues a symbolic rebuke of the Kennedy administration for its trade policy. So it's a real black eye to the Kennedy administration. And it happened because of grassroots conservative activism. that was amplified by the right-wing radio, by this new network of right-wing radio broadcasters that could take a local local action and turn it into a national movement.
Now, I want to get to the broadcasters before we leave those housewives behind.
Yeah.
This is something you talk about in the book, and if I can steal from another podcast on the network here and dip my toes into kind of Christian feminist territory for a minute. If I read second wave feminist literature coming from especially the late 1960s, but even the earlier part of the 60s, feminine mystique and those sorts of things, my image of housewives in America in that part of the century is that they're all kind of sitting at home bored and unfulfilled.
Right.
They're voiceless and they don't have any way to express themselves. And you talk about that a little bit in the book. So can you maybe talk a little more about the relationship between political activism and these largely conservative women?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah. Freddie Friedan shows up a little bit. You know, she's the one that wrote The Feminine Mystique. Yeah. It's notable. I mean, the Polish ham boycotts late 1962, which is exactly when she's putting the finishing touches on that book. And she depicts women as middle-class housewives, as frustrated domestic goddesses who had the freedom to, quote, choose automobiles, clothes, appliances, and supermarkets, but then at night lay next to their husbands asking themselves, is this all? And there's a kernel of truth there, of course.
Oh, sure, which is of course.
You know, there were lots of women who were essentially repressed. One of the funny things is you can see this reflected in the culture of the time. The phrase "mommy's little helper," the sheer quantity. We're talking hundreds of millions of doses of various antidepressants and tranquilizers were being sold over the counter to housewives all over the country. It was a real epidemic. We essentially addicted a generation of housewives to antidepressants.
This is way off the rails, but there's a book to be written about that, combined with, at the same time, this is when meth takes off in America, because all of these men are being given meth to help them work longer hours in the factories.
Yeah, and truck drivers, Dan. If you were a truck driver in the 1950s and 60s, you were definitely doing speed.
Yep. Or a factory worker, or yeah. I mean, anything that required longer hours. And if it's now, it's the husband and the wife, right, both on these medications. So yeah. Anyway, that's all by the wayside.
Well, and when you it explains a lot about household interactions at the time. I mean, you can imagine growing up in the era. And you hear people's stories about how their parents dealt with them. You know, the stories, I don't know, locking kids in the basement in the dark as a normal form of punishment, or just general household unpleasantness. Well, realize you have a generation of men who are military veterans who never received the kind of counseling, support for PTSD or the like, who are then on amphetamines and all their wives are on various pharmaceuticals with side effects, and like, oh yeah, no wonder households were so messed up at the time. So this is what Friedan's writing about, and there's truth here. But here's the thing: Friedan, you know, portrays that consumer choice. You can choose automobiles and clothes and appliances and supermarkets, but not careers, as a fundamentally apolitical act. But the reality is that consumer power gave women political power. And so what you had was women who, you know, they used their control over domestic consumption as a form of what I'm taking Michelle Nickerson's phrase here. She's a historian of right-wing female activism at the time. Housewife populism. So it was a chance to use the control over consumption to treat the nation as a kind of expanded household. You're in charge of what your own home consumes. You go and buy the groceries. You go and shop at the department store each week. Well, the nation, in this way of thinking, is itself a big household. And so women have a responsibility, even traditionally minded women, even anti-feminist women, have a responsibility to look out for the national household. And that wasn't considered inappropriately political or somehow, you know, outside of the sphere, or the domestic sphere. So that's kind of what Friedan misses. And she also misses that this impulse to engage in grassroots activism which he's encouraging on the left, is also happening on the right at the same time. It's not just a left-wing impulse. It's also a right-wing impulse. And so, and in fact, there's this funny moment I talk about in the book where one of these boycotting women writes to the male editor of Good Housekeeping magazine and says, hey, you gave your seal of approval, you know, the Good Housekeeping seal, to an Eastern communist import. I forget what it was offhand, if it was a ham or a chair or something. Anyways, she writes and complains, you shouldn't do that. This is bad for the American household. And he writes back and says, well, look, and he's ostensibly a progressive, you know, politically progressive individual at the time. He says, look, you know, lots of really smart people and your political representatives in Congress, who are all men, of course, they spent a lot of time thinking about this, and you should just quiet down and listen to what they have to say. So think about how anti-feminist that is, and how – so if you reframe what it means to be politically active as a woman in the 1960s, and you have all these – this interesting hybrid of anti-feminist feminists, both in the Polish ham boycott and then names that people are familiar with, like Phyllis Schlafly, who's, you know, in her own way an oddly anti-feminist feminist.
Yeah, great miniseries about her. Just came out, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, Miss America. Yeah, very good.
you mentioned the radio evangelist, televangelist. We have a name for. Do we have a word for these guys? That sort of kind of thing. Radio evangelist is clunky.
Yeah, radio evangelist is clunky. But no, we there's nothing quite like that. They were very aware, though. Sometimes they would call it the electric church. This is earlier than the 1960s, but they would talk about this. There was this idealism in the 1920s and 30s where they thought, like, suddenly now we have a church without walls. Anyone anywhere can listen to a preacher across the globe. And so we're being bonded together by invisible ties with believers from around the world. And people were very excited by the possibility of what that looked like, a non-literal, non-physical church that can gather and grow together and build ties. And you have a whole generation of, you know, this is earlier than the folks I study, but you think of your Charles Fuller,
right.
Ockenguy. You have all this generation of broadcasters in the 1930s and 40s who had these almost kind of utopian views of what was possible because of radio, the transformative potential there. It's actually kind of interesting in light of this current moment where their descendants, I mean, you think of evangelical broadcasters today or you know, national figures like John MacArthur and, right. and the like, who are very, very, very defensive of the importance of physical gathering. That would have felt kind of alien to folks in the 30s and 40s who were excited by the possibility of the electric church.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting. I want to read more about these guys. So when I think big name evangelical Protestants in the middle of the 20th century, I think, you know, Chuck Smith, I think Robert Schuller, I think sort of the Orange County crowd. I don't think Carl McIntyre or Billy Hargis, even though I now live right smack dab in the middle of Hargis country. I mean, he's from here. So I know people who still get angry about some of the stuff you talk about in your book if you bring it up to him. So tell us, before we get into the political side of it, just tell us a little bit about these guys. What are they doing on the radio? Where do they fit into your narrative here?
Yeah, what's interesting is that people remember the golden age of radio, like the 30s and 40s when it's network dominated. You have all these big, radio dramas like your Lone Rangers and your Green Lanterns and, you know, murder mysteries. And everyone would gather around the radio set at night, the whole family, to listen to FDR do a fireside chat. People remember the golden era age of radio, which was network dominated, which also tended to be kind of lowest common denominator, right? They want mass audiences. These are national networks. They control 95%+ of all radio stations. They don't want controversial stuff on the airwaves. So they squeeze off anyone who's a little too radical, either left or right, or who's too dissenting, who's too far outside the mainstream, which meant that there was this constant tension with evangelical broadcasters, evangelical fundamentalist broadcasters, who felt like they were being excluded by network radio. And they're right. I wrote a paper
because
about
they were,
this.
Yeah.
They were. They're not wrong. They tended to give free airtime or sustaining airtime, as it was called, to the big groups, like the Roman Catholic Church, the mainline churches, so they weren't called mainline at the time, the National Council of Churches. or then the Federal Council of Churches. They privilege the kind of mainstream, the large over the small and dissident. And in fact, this is one of the key reasons for the organization of the National Association of Evangelicals in the 1940s was to try to get a bigger slice of that radio pie. All this changes, though, in the 1950s. The networks are turning to television. That's the rage. Everything's TV, TV, TV. So radio goes from being network-dominated, over 95% of stations affiliated with a network in the 1940s, to less than half by the mid-50s and falling. It's like maybe a third by the 1960s. So you have all these new independent non-network radio stations, usually owned by the local car dealership. He would own a radio station so that he could promote his business. They're strapped for cash. They're open to airing pretty much anything. They're looking for cheap content. This provides an opportunity. So radio becoming niche allows previously excluded voices, and that includes fundamentalists and evangelicals like Billy James Hargis and Carl McIntyre, to really get a foothold on the airwaves and to go almost overnight. McIntyre's on like two radio stations in 1957. He's on more than 460 by 1964. So an explosion. He becomes, just for sake of comparison, about 20 million people a week listened to Carl McIntyre, to his broadcast. That's as many as Rush Limbaugh at the peak of his show some 50 years later, despite the national population being much larger, of course. 1 in 9 American households listened to right-wing radio in the early 1960s, when basically no one had just 10 years earlier. So it's an explosive growth provided for by the kind of the transformation of the radio and broadcasting industries. And so suddenly these guys like, Carl McIntyre, he's kind of out there. I mean, his little quasi-denomination, the American Council of Christian Churches, had a formal membership of, and this is sopping wet. I mean, this is, if you take his maximal claims, 125,000 people. Not a lot of folks. The National Council of Churches at the time claimed 45 million, right? So we're talking orders of magnitude more. And yet, Carl McIntyre's radio show by itself, he's just one broadcaster, but his show by itself raised about $2 million a year in small listener donations, while the entire National Council of Churches, its broadcasting and film division, only got about $250,000 in its annual budget. So it was 10x, nearly, it was like 8x, I guess, 7 or 8x more money. I had a listening audience that was, significantly larger, 20 million versus a few hundred thousand. So these big mainstream organizations were being outflanked by evangelical and fundamentalist dissidents like McIntyre, like Hargis. And that was this kind of radical new development in the early 1960s.
Yeah, so I grew up listening to Rush Limbaugh. Whether by choice or not, I it's hard to say because we only got the one or two stations in over the tractor radio. Benefits of growing up in the West. The repeated message, which may be coming back to bite us in the rear now, but the repeated message was the government is out to get us. The government is after conservatives. It's under the control of the liberals, and they're going to use the powers of government to do things like crush freedom of speech. Was he right? Why was he saying stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that, I have significant political differences with Rush Limbaugh today.
Sure.
But he's not wrong about this, or not entirely wrong. It's something he talks about a lot. If you actually listen to his show, I once tried to chart it for a piece I was writing. I think he mentioned the Fairness Doctrine in like 140 episodes over the last decade. And that's just, that's just the last decade, let alone his entire career. So he talks about, and the Fairness Doctrine was a mechanism for suppressing right-wing radio speech in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So that's why so it's a censorship tool. And right. So it's very much on, Rush Limbaugh gets involved in radio as a teenager in the late 1960s. It was very much part of his lived experience to worry about government suppression of right-wing speech. And in this regard, he is correct. As I detail in the book, the most successful episode of government censorship of the last half century targeted right-wing radio, and almost nobody has ever heard about it. So it's a remarkably successful and remarkably forgotten.
So can you tell us a little bit about that? I don't want to you know, sure, get people not to buy your book. But listener, you should go get this book and read it to get all the details. But can you tell us what the Fairness Doctrine is and how the government uses it?
Sure. So Fairness Doctrine, some version of it had existed for some time before the 1960s. It's not codified until 1959. What it is, though, it's an attempt to try to balance two obligations. So when the Federal Radio Commission, later the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, when it's instituted, they want two things. First of all, they don't want crazy people on the airwaves. And of course, their definition of crazy is anyone who is outside the mainstream. So they don't want socialists on the airwaves, but they also don't want, like, anti-New Deal critics on the airwaves and anti-Semites. And so they don't want Charles Coughlin, who was a big broadcaster in the 30s, both an anti-Semite and a critic of the New Deal. But they don't want socialist labor organizations like the some of the precursors, the AFL-CIO, tried to get radio station licenses and had a real fight because, well, we don't want socialists, those crazy radicals. They're almost as bad as the anti-New Dealers. So they wanted, you know, respectable, middle-brow, mainstream types to air. But the problem was if by trying to only encourage those kind of people to have radio station licenses and to create broadcasts, it tended to discourage people talking about politics and current events. But they wanted that. They think, you know, there's a positive obligation. We want folks to be talking about political issues, to talk about controversial stuff. But we also don't want them doing a little too much of that. So their attempt to balance that was to say, we're going to have this doctrine called the Fairness Doctrine, which gives you an affirmative obligation to talk about controversial issues of public importance, which is a fancy way of saying talk about current events in politics. But when you talk about them, don't be unbalanced. You should air kind of both major sides of opinion on a given issue. So if you air something criticizing the Kennedy administration's conduct of the Bay of Pigs, you know, the attempted U.S.-backed invasion of Cuba, well, you should air something that's supportive of it. You should kind of do a both sides, do some both sides stuff. Now, you can get away with this because this is radio. Now, if this was not radio, there's no way this would be considered, you know, prior restraint, censorship. You know, imagine if newspapers were required by the government to cover both sides of an issue, that you had to literally, if you criticized the Obama administration, you had to also run an article praising the Obama administration. I mean, that's you can't get away with that in print, but you can in radio for a variety of complicated reasons I won't get into here. So the Fairness Doctrine, though, attempts to do that. It's never really enforced until the 1960s, however. And what happens is the Kennedy administration says, aha, technically the Fairness Doctrine is supposed to be enforced against unbalanced expression on both sides. But what if, and hear me out here, what if we only go after one side using the Fairness Doctrine? If we only go after unbalanced conservative expressions of points of view? We can weaponize this and shut down people who are just driving us crazy, attacking our Polish ham trade policy, attacking our conduct, our Cuban foreign policy. We can shut them down by selectively enforcing the Fairness Doctrine. So that's what they do. The Kennedy administration, working with its allies in the labor movement and in other kind of liberal organizations, ultimately they interact with the National Council of Churches, which I talk about in the book some as well. They use a selected, targeted enforcement of the Fairness Doctrine to shut down, to threaten people who own radio station licenses, that if you continue to air these conservative broadcasters without also airing, you know, I guess liberal broadcasters, you could lose your license. These are called Fairness Doctrine complaints. So the threat of a Fairness Doctrine complaint was a way of, it was like a cudgel. That if you want to get your license renewed at renewal time, you know, in 2 years, you better watch how critical you – unbalanced and critical you are of the Kennedy administration. They also do some other things as part of the censorship campaign. Probably the most notable one for our purposes is targeted audits by the Internal Revenue Service. So if you can encourage station owners to drop – your Hargises and McIntyres because of their unbalanced expression of conservative speech, you can also go after the money. And, you know, these programs are very dependent on small dollar list or contributions. The funding model looks something like National Public Radio, you know, those fundraising right. drives. If those organizations then were tax exempt, they were considered educational organizations. If you can challenge their tax exempt status, people will donate less money. So they do targeted, the Kennedy administration literally, and I follow the paper trail in the book, they order the IRS to challenge the tax exempt status, to, you know, audit these right wing radio shows as a way of drying up the supply of funding to them. Which is, I mean, for listeners who follow politics today, this might remind you a little bit of the Lois Lerner IRS Tea Party scandal. So the head of the IRS was accused of delaying the approval of tax exempt status for Tea Party groups back during the Obama administration. Right. There is no evidence that she was instructed to do so by the Obama administration. So to be clear, the Occam's razor situation, she just didn't like Tea Party groups personally and politically and tried to slow roll them. But imagine if you found out that the Obama administration was angry that right-wing talk radio, that your Rush Limbaughs were criticizing the ACA, were criticizing Obamacare, and he wanted to shut them up. And so he instructed the head of the IRS to selectively audit these right-wing radio stations and to remove any kind of privileged tax status that they had. Imagine you found smoking gun evidence that he did so. That would be an incredible scandal. It's a scandal on the scope of on the scale of Watergate, again, that no one's ever really heard of. And that's what we're talking about actually happening in the 1960s.
Right. And so why couldn't radio stations just say, all right, fine, we'll put someone on from the other side? Send us your administration representative. We'll put a microphone in front of them and let them have their time.
Good question. Yeah. So the reason for that is that they're having to then – remember, these are mostly small business owners who own like a single station or two. They're cash strapped. You know, they're barely able to meet the salaries and the expenses of their station each month, which is why they took people who – I mean, most of these station owners didn't much like – they didn't share McIntyre or Hargis's politics typically. They just – the only color they saw was the color green, right?
Right.
And they're running on razor-thin margins. Here's what happens, though. The FCC not only says you need to balance the speech that you air, but also that if someone attacks – this is something called the equal time provision, that if one of the people you air criticizes another person. So if I say that – here's a literal case. One of these right-wing broadcasters said that Lyndon Johnson was lying to us about the Gulf of Tonkin affair, which was an inciting incident for the escalation of U.S. involvement right. in Vietnam. They accused him of lying.
Which he was, right?
He knew, he infamously said, I don't care if it's a whale, the radar ghosts, or a Vietnamese boat. This is, I don't care. He, of course, didn't admit he was lying at the time. He said, Laha, you attacked me personally under the equal time rule. You should give the administration a chance to respond. And what the FCC did was, in addition to the Fairness Doctrine, they had something called the Coleman Doctrine that was developed, again, essentially in consultation with the Kennedy administration a year earlier, which was that if you're attacked and you say that you can't afford to pay for response time, the station still has to air your response time for free. So every attack is a potential – you're not only so it suddenly becomes twice as costly. You're not letting someone pay to respond. You're giving them free airtime. You also have an obligation to keep track of when those attacks happen, and you're supposed to tell them that they were attacked so that they can demand free response time for you. So there's an administrative overhead that's required as part of that. So it just stops paying. It's a very effective way to say, look, you cash-strapped struggling organization, we're going to make you give away free airtime if you air conservative broadcasters, and they just can't afford to. So all except for the truly hardcore committed, the ones who share these conservative broadcasters' views, start dropping the programs en masse starting in 64 through the late 60s. So that's why they can't just do that, and that's why it's such an effective censorship tool.
So what is the response of these broadcasters?
I mean, they're angry, unsurprisingly. no one really cares about them. They don't have any real allies. the Republican Party, they were too extreme for the Republican Party. Most politicians held them a bit of an arm's remove. They were considered part of the kind of radical wing, along with like the John Birch Society and the like. So they were happy to have them help out when it came time to rouse up the, you know, foot soldiers in time to go knock on doors for a camp for an election. But they weren't willing to actually spend political capital defending them. It also wasn't – remember, this was mostly covered up. There were a few leaks that drew attention. But the FCC could plausibly say, what do you mean this is part of some sort of Kennedy administration scheme to censor the right-wing radio? Where's your proof? And they couldn't prove that. I mean, I can prove that because I can go into their own archives. I can find, you know, the Oval Office tapes where Kennedy discusses the censorship campaign. But obviously they didn't have access to that information. So they were angry, and they weren't entirely sure angry at who exactly. Is the National Council of Churches responsible? Is Kennedy responsible? And then what's your proof? And so they challenged the Fairness Doctrine in court. Carl McIntyre was losing the radio station license for a station he owned in Pennsylvania called WXUR. He took it to the court system, and the court said, well, where's your evidence that you're, you know, that this isn't just an ordinary expression of a generic application of FCC regulations? What do you mean you think it's targeted? Where's your proof of that? And he didn't have any. You know, I have it, but he didn't. So he lost, and he lost his radio station. His whole ministry kind of crumbled as a result. Billy James Hargis, he won the court case. There was a court case over his tax-exempt status, you know, began with an IRS audit. He won, but it took, you know, the better part of a decade, hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. And so it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory. But then he messes up his own ministry through his – he's essentially the Jerry Falwell Jr. of his time period involving sexual impropriety. So he brings down his own ministry as well. But they just didn't have proof of this. So their response – they were angry and upset, but not entirely sure who they should be upset at, and without any real hard evidence of the fact that they were victims of a censorship campaign.
Right. And you mentioned the political parties not being willing to go to bat for them. We should probably also mention their stance on segregation, just to be forward about. Can you talk a little bit about them, these broadcasters, and race?
Yeah. Real quick, definitely, because that's an important part about the book. One more note here. Sure. I have this great picture I found from a listener. One of McIntyre's listeners sent him a photo of their little, like, adorable little three-year-old girl standing with an American flag in front of their van. The van decals showed in big letters, UN equals hammer and sickle equals communism equals swastika equals Nixon. You know, and they were constantly attacking the Nixon administration for being overly – not being conservative enough. And so when they came to the Nixon administration at one point trying to ask for relief from the Fairness Doctrine, well, Nixon wasn't going to help them out. He had zero interest in helping out these people who attacked him. So the point being that neither party was really there was going to be no aid from either political party at the time, which is very different from the 1980s and 90s and the second wave of mass right-wing radio and, you know, rise of Rush Limbaugh and talk radio and the like. On race, so yeah, it's important to remember, like, these folks were victims of the censorship campaign, but that doesn't make them innocent as the driven snow. I mean, they had some very views that most of us would find deeply objectionable, right? They were segregationists, generally supportive of Jim Crow laws, of segregation restrictions. That includes Carl McIntyre, Billy James Hargis. And in fact, in both of their cases, especially McIntyre's, he was raised in the border countries. He went to college in Missouri. So it's the South, but it's the upper South, not the deep South. His own views on segregation and racism were, while not progressive by any means, even by the standards of his time, they were relatively moderate. But they realized, these broadcasters realized by the early 60s that there was a real growth potential if they changed their message to be more hardcore in support of segregation. And indeed, you can actually map the growth, their biggest growth territory. Even though McIntyre's broadcasting from New Jersey, hardly the heart of Dixie, and Billy James Hargis from Oklahoma, this is not the Deep South, and yet their biggest audiences after a certain point in the 60s was in the Deep South. And so they knew that. They purposefully took a harder tack on segregation or to appeal to, you know, white massive resistance in the South. And so, yeah, the causes that they were promoting were often unsavory. But here's the important thing from a historical standpoint. If you hear the usual story about where the kind of partisan transformation of the South comes from, how the South went from being solidly Democratic early in the 20th century to solidly Republican by the late 20th century. And it was a real transformation. If you look at election maps between sure. early and late, it goes from deep blue to deep red. Well, how did that happen? Well, the usual story is that it's up to maybe Goldwater, but especially Richard Nixon in 68 and 72 adopting what's called the Southern Strategy, that these, you know, clever political operatives tried to woo disaffected white Southern Democrats over to the Republican Party. And they did. But here's the key that people miss out on. In as much as they were playing that role in, you know, 64, 68, 72, the groundwork for that transformation was laid by right-wing radio hosts years before. They played the kind of John the Baptist role for the coming of a segregationist Jesus here. But no, because put it out this way, if you're a we know that partisan affiliation is one of the stickiest identities that we have. People are more likely to change religions than they are political parties. People are more likely, if you actually poll people, they are more likely to say, I'm okay with my children engaging in an interracial relationship than they are engaging in a cross-partisan relationship, right? So it's right. a very sticky, hard-to-change political identity or affiliated identity. And you have to get people to really change so much of their mental architecture to imagine switching parties. So you have people who their entire lives, they've been Democrats. Their parents' lives were Democrats. Their grandparents, they were Democrats. How do you get them to imagine becoming Republicans? Well, maybe when they turn on the airway on the radio and they hear Carl McIntyre, who is a New Jersey Republican, who is preaching a hardcore segregationist line, that helps them imagine – hey, I can keep the political views, my racist political views that are very important to me, and yet change parties, and that's okay. So it expands their imagination of what's possible. And I think that role, the role of the radio right in preparing the way for the Southern Strategy, has never really been explored until this book.
Right. How then do we get to Rush Limbaugh if the government has this policy of squashing, I assume, generally freedom of speech. I mean, obviously you're dealing with the perspective on the right, but then Reagan takes over and you know, to some extent, what's to stop him from just turning it around and, you know, shutting off whatever liberal radio programs there are in the 1980s. I think I'm comfortable saying we do have some kind of expanded freedom of speech on the airwaves today, discussions about net neutrality aside. How do we get there?
Absolutely. That's actually if I was to write a sequel to this book, it would be, you know, that's the core question of the book that I'd be seeking to explore. But in a nutshell, let's go back to the 1970s. The Fairness Doctrine campaign has been very successful. Right-wing radio is a shell of its former self. We get to the Carter administration, and as people on the right like to remember Ronald Reagan as the great deregulator, but that's not – I mean, yes, air traffic controller union, but that's about the only thing. The real great deregulator was Jimmy Carter. Now, yes, he's a Democrat, but he's a Southern Democrat, and he's actually very much – across federal administrations, he appoints a bunch of conservative Democrats to head various agencies, including – I mean, he's the one responsible for the deregulation of beer. If you like craft beer, you can thank Jimmy Carter, because there were like four brands of beer available in the 70s, and now there's thousands. If you like cheap air travel, it was the Jimmy Carter administration that deregulated price controls on air traffic routes. And if you like talk radio or even the political diversity on cable news and satellite radio, you have the Carter administration to thank for it. So it's actually Carter whose FCC stops enforcing the Fairness Doctrine. It's still on the books, but they kind of stop enforcing it as vigorously. And because of that, there's kind of room there for politically charged, you know, radical political expression on the airwaves once again. Reagan, then his FCC formally drops the Fairness Doctrine in 87. And so then the lane is clear for, you know, much more free speech on the radio airwaves. And that's when the, you know, talk radio takes off in the late 80s as a result. So that's the proximate cause. Now, there is an interesting subsequent question here, which is, why does talk radio become so right-wing? Right? Like, if you say talk radio today, people immediately think of Rush, Michael Medved. Right. They think of right-wing hosts. And indeed, if you look at the list of the top 10 most popular talk radio stations, only one of them is left of center in any kind of consistent way. So it's dominated by conservative voices. But the important thing to remember, and one explanation for that is just that, well, see, I mean, this is the version that talk radio hosts themselves like. It just shows you the silent majority. Most Americans are conservative. That's why we won, because it's just a clear expression of the American will. But the reality is this. It's structural. I love structural explanations. It's, if you look at the 1980s, and there's a dissertation by a colleague named Brian Rosenwald. He didn't talk about this in his book, but in the dissertation he does. Where if you look at the 1980s, the talk radio space is actually pretty evenly divided between left and right-wing voices. It's not skewed heavily to the right like it is by the 90s and especially today. What happens, though, is that right-wing voices don't have a natural competitor in that space. Left-wing voices do, and maybe you're already anticipating where I'm going with this. If you want to turn on your radio station and find kind of left-center expression of current events and politics, your options aren't include things like National Public Radio. Now, they're only kind of mildly left of center. They're not radical lefties, despite what, you know, talk radio hosts might have you believe. They're generally left of center, but there is no right of center competitor on the airwaves for talk radio. They have the full right side of the spectrum, the full right half, if you will. But if you're a radio station owner in the 1980s, and remember, your goal as the radio station owner is to find programs, to purchase syndicated programs that you think will attract the most listeners so you can sell the best ad spots to local businesses, okay? It's dollars and cents here. Are you going to choose the right-wing talk radio host or the left-wing talk radio host? Who has the widest audience appeal? Well, obviously the right-wing guy, because he's attracting everyone to the right of the left of center National Public Radio. If you choose a left-wing guy, they've got a baked-in competitor. And so there was a huge structural disadvantage created by a government distortion of the radio airwaves, a government, you know, subsidized left of center radio outlet, NPR. And so that explains the kind of conservative takeover of the talk radio space. I don't really talk about that in my book. I mentioned it briefly. It's towards the end. But that's how we arrive at conservative dominance of the talk radio airwaves and how we, you know, the rise of talk radio. And so if I can have one moral of the story here, one big picture thing out of the nitty gritty, it is that we spend way too much of our time. And this is generally applicable, not just how we view history, but how we view politics today. We spend like 90% of our time focused on the surface level, on the retail politics, on the personalities, on the nitty-gritty, the red versus blue tribalism, what Marx called the epiphenomenal. And we should spend way more time focused on – we should flip that. We should spend 90% of our time focused on the structural, the rules that are created by government and the structures, the institutions, the stuff below the surface that actually shapes the retail, that shapes the surface-level stuff. So spend more time looking at structural, less at retail.
Right. I think there's in terms of the left versus right post-fairness doctrine enforcement, I have to imagine one of the structural factors is AM radio versus FM radio also, mm-hmm. right? Especially given how much farther AM radio carries, it's going to include all of your rural communities in a way that FM never will. And those are going to skew more right wing than left wing. I don't know that. I don't have the research, but I can't imagine that's not also a structural factor. Like if you're a radio station owner and you're thinking, what do I want to put on my FM radio station versus AM radio station?
Yeah.
And all of this is
– That plays a role, too, with the – I mean, there's a reason why FM was much more likely to be turned over to, all music, all day music formats, because right. FM, it doesn't carry as far, but it has superior sound quality. And so for music, that's important. And music is generally applicable. I mean, if you want the widest possible audience, just play the top 40 hits and people will listen, right, from across the political spectrum. AM is less profitable because the audio quality is lower. And again, since it's less profitable, it's cheaper to buy. It's cheaper to, you know, it's just generally cheaper to get the license, to find programming, which is an opportunity for radicals who don't have quite as large of a mainstream appeal. So, yeah, definitely.
Right. And all of this is before the big what would we even call this? Clear Channel tsunami of the late 90s, right? So which presumably if you were to write a third book, something along those lines would have to be included. I should have looked this up before the interview. I have no idea where radio station ownership stands today. So you talked about 40s and 50s, there's this collapse of the networks into private ownership, and then I know in the 90s there was the rise of corporate ownership, and I could not tell you where things are. I guess if you know, you can mention, but
yeah, there's been a lot of consolidation again, which has been very alienating. You think of like the Sinclair Group, they own both television and radio stations, but there's been general a trend towards consolidation. It's not nearly as consolidated as it was in the 30s and 40s, where like, you know, three networks controlled the overwhelming majority of radio stations. But it has been a trend towards consolidation, which has been disconcerting to kind of progressive FCC watchers. The real corollary today to this moment I'm talking about isn't really radio so much. I mean, there, obviously talk radio is the literal example. But if you think of it in terms of new mass media form, that because of the low barriers to entry and the ability to appeal to huge distributed audiences allows – for a greater diversity of radical speech, it's podcasting. So the the barrier to entry for podcasting is incredibly low. Anyone can start a podcast, and it seems like everybody and their brother has. Yeah, anyone. I mean, even Coral can start. You know, and there's a literal example here. I mean, the Christian Humanist podcast, or it's not Christian Humanist, is it? It's
Radio Network. Christian Humanist Radio Network.
None of the podcasts on the Christian Humanist Radio Network would have been able to find a slot on terrestrial radio, and very few. If you were big dogs like, I don't know, Grace to You, John MacArthur, or, you know. You have been squeezed out. You're too niche and not mainstream enough to find a spot in the old mass media forms. But you can in podcasting. So we're seeing a lot more ideological and political diversity in the podcasting space than in, you know, older mass media forms. So it's that, again, that – moment of opportunity, the lower barriers to entry, the kind of supply side crunch, there's a demand for more of this content, provides an opportunity for previously excluded voices to get a hearing. So you are, I mean, there you go. We are both participants in our version of the 1960s right-wing radio boom.
Right, without the millions of listeners, which is okay. I don't need that kind of scrutiny.
Hey, you can tell us if you actually have 20 million listeners in your
account. We do not have 20 million listeners. Our number, if you knock multiple zeros off of that, you're a lot closer to our number. I actually kind of thought you were going to go in a different direction, where the equivalent of that today is social media, right? Basically, no barriers to entry. To the best of my knowledge, no government regulation whatsoever. But still some kind of oversight by whoever owns it, right? Whoever's got the green in the background.
Yeah. I mean, there are corollaries there, but it's a little bit different. It's not exactly a mass media form. So for something to be a mass media, it needs a large audience. Then also a media tends to have some organization. So like in social media, every member of society is their own little media organization, but it's not exactly the same as a CBS or a Christian Humanist Network. It's not organized. It's just so distributed as to be – it's too atomized, right? So it's a little bit different. There are corollaries in the sense, though, that like social media has lowered the barriers to entry. Anyone can speak. It clearly has massive grassroots organization potential. It's propelling activism, both for good and for ill. It's essentially a free space. It's actually much freer. I mean, the internet post 1996 is a much freer space than radio or television broadcasting ever were, part because of Section 230 and other protections. But also because even before Section 230, the internet was largely regulated under the kind of print media standards versus the broadcast. Remember, broadcasting, because of some jurisprudential chicanery in the 1920s and 30s, they pretended like it was fundamentally different from print speech. But the internet, the precursors for the internet are really from print media. And so they were regulating internet speech kind of like bookstores. Anyways, I won't get down the weeds. Right. But because of that, the internet has been a much freer form of expression from birth than broadcasting was.
Right. For good and evil. Right. I'd actually love to have you back on to talk about that. That is outside of my professional wheelhouse. But there was a time about 5 years ago when publishers kept sending me these like popular histories of the early era of the internet, and I think it's fascinating. I'd love to have you back on to talk about that sometime.
Sure.
Dr. Matsko, thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll stop monopolizing your time there and let you go. And listener, please go out and pick up the book, The Radio Right. It's a great read and full of all sorts of interesting information about stuff that we should have known all along but didn't. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning into the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high